This show at Real 7. We're talking about your time when you were in charge of the radar station of 91st HAA Regiment, just outside to the south of Alexandria. What about, did you actually have any German or Italian air raids or whatever there?
Oh, yes.
What would happen? What
would happen? Well, you get probably a warning, or perhaps there was no warning. Well, always, all the time, I had directly the reconnaissance planes coming across. They were generally J-88s, J-88 planes, which flew at a very high level for that time. Far too high for us to be able to worry about, although sometimes we fire token shots at the aircraft, maybe for the population. But often there were bombing raids, so there were harbour. Because, as I say, it was the main port, and there were British battleships in, and so we had to engage. We had, as I say, harbour barrage, and we would do all that harbour barrage, and the guns would shoot off the predetermined angle and height and all that.
Now, what would you do at your radar station or site when there was a raid?
Or there was a raid, we would try to follow. I keep saying try to because we were successful. We weren't madly successful, but we did what we could. We'd follow the blitz and try and report the blitz to the main control office, wherever that was, in Cairo. Targets that were approaching from wherever it was, and give the bearing and say the angle, so they also could plot where the aircraft were coming. That was the basic thing. We follow the plots of the incoming aircraft. Sometimes they had problems with trying to distinguish whether it was enemy, whether it was a half aircraft, or had trouble. But there were a lot of bombing raids, but also, this is an important thing, Alexandria, it didn't direct, we weren't directly involved, we had these two main submarines which sank some very big ships in Alexandria. Particularly the Italians had developed these small submarines. Other countries developed them, didn't copy them afterwards. They had two men on them. They'd come close to the, and they would somewhere or other, they got under the net or whatever, they were guarding the harbour. And apply bombs to the bottoms of the battleships, the warship, with tiny devices, and then hopefully they would try to get away. Sometimes they were detected, and on some occasions they were taken, put in the bottom of the ship, saying, "You tell us just where these entrance mines are." The underwater thing was pretty primitive in those days, but the Italians were in advance on that. Strange enough, after the war, when I was involved with Italy, an engineering thing, met up with a man who was in charge of the Italian thing, fellow Stefanini, and got interested. He was developing that.
But you wouldn't have any direct contact with that at the time.
No, not with that.
You were just aware of it.
We're aware of it. I did. Now I am pretty sure that I noticed this in my diary. I was looking at yesterday, and it must have been about that time. Enemy aircraft would blow shot down, whether by our team or whatever. And I remember a note there that it was my first contact with dead bodies, because we went up where the plane had crashed, German plane, and there were, at one point, there were two bodies and an arm that had been blown off, and then that was lying on the cell, and it was my first contact. But again, I think it's a little cold about it. I don't think I've looked at with horror. That's all, obviously, that sort of thing. But I don't remember going into a kind of nervous or anything like that. It's just accepted. What else in the Alexandria area? See, they were constantly posting officers, then of course, to very base depots as reinforcements. Even on the ship, there was some nominal, you know, going to be first line reinforcement or whatever, and I then was posted as a reinforcement. This was getting on towards March, April, May.
I think it's May in the book. In this.
Yes. And I was posted to base depot, our base depot, the Royal Artillery base depot, doing TV Atkins near Cairo, yes, near Cairo. But you've got to remember at that stage what was happening on the war front. This was, what, say, May, April, May 42. Germans have been advancing all over the place into Russia. Japanese were advancing the Africa Corps, which had been, not Africa Corps, the Italians had been thrown back, the Wavell, but Rommel had come over, and the Africa Corps was born, the German soldiers, and they were advancing towards Egypt. And I went as reinforcement base depot, and I was there for a week or whatever, and I was then posted to the 8th Army. That was the start of my career.
Now that was the 94th Heavy
HAA, Heavy Attack Regiment. I joined them at a place called Fort Capuzzo, which I think was just the other side of the Libyan-Egyptian border. There was Solum, which I think was just on the Egyptian side, port. Everything that was along the coast. Very little activity further south, and then you had Lynch, Desert Group, and things like that. But basically, everything happened within 10 miles of the coast. I went to join them there when the 8th Army were in full retreat.
And that would be June 1942, according to this.
Yes. Now, there's something just showing how your whole life can depend on little action. The toss of a coin literally determined what was going to happen to me during the rest of the war. Another young officer and I were going up reinforcements to the regiment, and he was going to one battery, and I was going to the other battery. At that time, Tobruk was about to fall. Not fought, but be overtaken, be cut off by the Germans. Now, as you may remember, a couple of years previously, Tobruk had gone into a box, as we called them, where they stayed there, even though the Germans or the Italians, whoever, was all the way around, it was fed by sea, and it's thought Tobruk was going to become another one of those. One battery was going to stay in Tobruk, of the regiment, another battery was going to go back with the 8th Army then to Alamein, didn't know at that time it was going to Alamein. Battery commanders left to themselves to decide who was going to stay. They decided what possible point. The other battery commander, not the one that which I was going, won the toss. And in true British military style, said, right, we will stay here, you can retreat. So my battery came back with me, coming back towards Egypt, whereas the other battery stayed in Tobruk. Within a couple of days, literally, Tobruk.
Now, which battery were you with? Do you remember that number?
I don't know. I think it's something like 231. I may have got, but of course, I had to be a bit careful. Once I got into any sort of field of action, I had to be a bit more careful what I put in the diaries. So, referring to numbers of batteries and even units, I was a bit more careful. I did some things in code, if I can't remember the code. But I think 311 was one of the units, but as I say, it's not easy to remember that. One had to be a bit cautious, even mentioning the name, the places. But I had to be careful of the diary, you know, that diaries could be dangerous if you're captured.
Now, you did keep a diary. I mean, that were you, wasn't that, you weren't supposed to, really?
Well, there was half and half. You weren't supposed to. I agree that it was probably wrong. And if any of the men had been found carrying, filling in a diary every day or more sort of day, then it probably would have been stopped. I don't know if anyone even knew. I didn't hide. I didn't secretly do it or anything. And they probably knew that I was doing it. Maybe they see people that didn't bother seeing about being careful. I was rather careful. Often what I would do is if there was going to be some action, after all, information quickly becomes stale. It's information of what's happening the last couple of days and what's going to happen in the next few days. There was nothing, I wouldn't be involved in anything that was momentous from a strategic point of view of the course of the war. I didn't know anything about when D-Day was going to be and where it was going to be. But as far as the particular units, whether we were at up to Gela or to Brockhorst or normal or wherever it was, that's not true. That could be a bit relevant, but I sometimes left it for a day or two, maybe put a little thing in pencil, just to remind me, and then a few days later, when things settled down, I sent it in when I was already still fresh in my mind. That was my concession, and also I even had a bit careful about what I wrote, trying to be careful. It was that. And De Brock. So De Brock was about four. We didn't know it was four. I joined them just on the Libyan side of the and that was my first introduction to actual direct land war. Shells were exploding all around, and the army was going back like mad.
How did you react to your first experience under fire?
I don't know the way I describe it, as I assumed this was happening all the time when you're in an army at war. The shells were going off, bombs were falling, so I took that as being just a normal run of things. I don't recall being scared. There were injuries, so people were not particularly in mind, so that was later, basically, in advancing. And just took it as being a usual run of things. An interesting point, actually. I didn't know until looking at my diaries again that I was so keen on swimming. I mentioned that everything happened along the coast. At every opportunity, I would go and have a swim in the Mediterranean. If there was we knew we were going to move off at 3:30 in the morning, then at 2 o'clock when we got more or less ready, I'd go off and have a swim and come back. And that happened all the way along. I could more or less write a book about the quality of the swimming along the coast of North Africa.
Now, when you joined them, how did the unit compare to your old, the 91st?
It was all
in what way?
Rough and ready. There was less formality. Just formality. Where you dressed, did things, everything. Because after all, you were moving all the time. So you ate when you could. Long flight moving, very rarely in the same place as more than a day or two. So everything was rough and ready. You ate out of the things, you slept in the open. If the batman, if you had time, the batman would set up a tent bed for you. I don't think he even set a pitch tent because there was so much movement.
Wouldn't you have a period in the El Alamein period?
Before we got back to it.
Before that, yeah, okay.
We're now just about a week or so, or 10 days, so things were moving rather fast. So, almost immediately, very soon after, so I then got orders to move back, and it was all done in stages. Leaks probably with people, airfields and so on. There was a pass between on the border between Egypt and Libya called literally Hellfire Pass. We obviously called it Hellfire Pass. So there was a bit of winding snake pass going up the escarpment, and any vehicle broke down, and we just tipped them over the side and stopped to try to repair them. There was a constant stream of stuff going back. And we gradually moved back. I gave a talk once about that, and I had a map which I made up of a simple map. Yes, that was the thing. We were now at the Hellfire Pass, Hawkins, Butcher, and Sodom. So Tobruk was just there. And then, in effect, we were right back to the Alamein there. The railhead was at went as far as Mersin was true, but El Dada wrote something to do what happened there. And then gradually we had orders moving back. We'd move maybe 50, 100 miles at a time to a new position. We were fun with staff and some injuries, not so many casualties.
Were you firing much?
Yes. Gosh, Norm's now firing and. Day and night, and there were hundreds of rounds being fired. But again, I thought that was just a normal thing. That's the way wars were fought.
What would that? You were a gun position officer, so what was your. Could you give us a bit of.
I'd be in charge of there was a. I was second lieutenant, there'd be a full lieutenant in charge of this particular section that I was in, and then there was a captain who was. And the captain, the major, the battle commander, the major, then the captain was just under him. He was also in charge of administration of the various sections. And I'd be in charge with the telephone senior officer of everything related to the camp, all the feeding raids and movement, make sure the women got orders to move, to that the guns were taken out of action, because there was quite a job getting the guns ready for to move. Because when they were in action, they were had to be on these three platforms. It was quite a complicated procedure, and it had to be done all in order. You couldn't put the wheels on until all this other things were done. So it was quite a job getting out of action. It would take maybe an hour to get all the guns ready for the road. And you had to check that all that was being done, the stuff was being loaded, in case you were going to be attacked at the same time. It was quite an exciting activity. And sometimes you'd get into action, and an hour later come out of action, all over again. And when you were going to move back, somebody more senior person generally would go along and choose the gun sites that we were going to occupy, and all that. And then when you got it all, everything loaded up, you would lead, you know, move off sort of thing, get mounted, move off, you know, simple like that, you know, start up the engine.
The circle of your hand, yeah.
And then move off, and one would go in the front vehicle, or ahead of it. Sometimes I would do a motorcycle, but I like to ride a motorcycle as well.
What about convoy discipline? Did you have that?
Oh, very much so. Very important that you had to keep a certain distance from the vehicle in front. You'd have, if you're travelling at night, you had a differential at the back of the rear axle painted white. So that would sort of stand out a bit more. You have to be very careful with your lights, and you just follow that. Well, when often you're going across the desert where there was no power, and you just had to make sure that you just kept in touch with the vehicle in front, otherwise you'd be lost. And if you wandered off into the minefield, and particularly when you were advancing, when you went through minefields.
Ah, I'll come to that, because that's a bit later. So you're driving in convoy, so moving back in stages, firing a lot. Anything else about this period, before we get to Old Darba?
No, that's what happened. I kept moving and swimming. I don't know why I swam. And also, strange enough, in my diary, I had one reference when we were retreating, but we stopped somewhere a little more. I was having a philosophic discussion with somebody about some matter, nothing to do with the army, pure moral, philosophical discussion. And my idea, I said, my God, I must be pretty either precocious or presumptuous or whatever it was to have been discussing that sort of thing in that situation. But we did, because again, one very quickly took all this for granted, the normal way of behaviour. El Darba was rather exciting. El Darba was at that point the railhead. The enemy were quite close, and whatever was falling, and my job was to get to the railhead with a number of men and load a number of predictors onto the railway wagon, the last train that was going to leave before the Germans overran it, because these predictors are very valuable, very important, very secret, although I'm sure the Germans got to know pretty quickly about it. I had to load these onto the. They'd been collected from a store or something, and the few had to be taken back to the Delta.
So it wasn't just your regiment's predictors, this was
And we went and we were loading them onto the truck amid the bombs were falling all the way around. It's at night time as well. And then it was very, very exciting doing that. And we had to, leave. Awesome amount of equipment, very valuable, very expensive equipment, but just couldn't get it on time, so we had to move further back.
How many predictors are we talking? I mean,
there were probably in each section had one.
No, but how many were you loading on the train?
There must have been probably something like a dozen around there, and I've got most of them on number, I don't remember. But I remember thinking there was an enormous amount of equipment, other equipment, lying around. It just had to be left there. The Germans did the same. When we overran their places, there were loads of equipment, their equipment, that we found. Well, they had to take the booby traps and things, but that happened. And then and we got ordered to retreat further back to, in fact, we went back through another main, went a bit further back, and then came a bit forward, and we stopped then at this place, brought the alarm up.
You took up gun positions
gun
there.
Gun position there, yeah. That was a mile or two.
Could you describe these deserts, well, sort of desert, coastal region, actually, could you describe the gun positions you took up at Berg El Arab?
Yes, the ground was what we call scrub. It was hard sand covering the ground. It was sort of hard, not always, because you had, when the wind would blow, you may have a whole area where the sand was terribly soft, and the guns would be bogged down. But generally, there was a road, apart from where the road went all the way across. Well, along that road was the only known thoroughfare. And we would probably be something like a mile or so south of the road, which meant south of the coast. That was generally speaking, because there'd be airfields around there. The airfields were sort of moving back, and that's basically what we were defending. So at Berg El Arab, we would have been about a mile south. It'd be a track, which probably we may have made ourselves. There wouldn't be any road. The whole of that road there was wasn't really tarmac. It was a hard road. Part of it may have been tarmac. The Italian road, part of it was better than the Egyptian. We just had to make our way there. So we staged it. We're at Berg El Arab for, I think, several months.
Now, what can you describe the gun positions and the actual? Because you had time to develop them there a bit, and as opposed to just plonk the guns on the ground.
We then obviously stabilised the situation roughly where I described before, where the actual command post would become would be the frame of a tree tower with canvas on top. Probably dug down a bit, maybe sandbags around it, and so when you were in it, even if you were standing, your head would probably be above the thing, but you were largely protected. The gun position, guns stacked and so on, let's say about maybe 30 yards away, like that, and about 30 yards apart from each other, would also be put into pits, gun pits, and they would probably have sandbags around them to protect them. And that's the way, and there'd be the cables going from the guns to the command post and plugged into the computer and whatever. And that's where it would be. The men would sleep in tents near the gun position, their own gun position. So if you had some alarm, take post or whatever it was, they'd be in a minute or two be on their gun position, on their seats where they're supposed to be, or polish the ammunition, or getting it ready, all that sort of thing. You did constant drills to be able to do that, or something that I was in the sleep.
Now, what about your where you lived?
Well, we would also be in a tent. There we would be in a tent. Two officers sharing a tent.
Was it dug in? If you know, I mean,
yes, I think it would have been dug in a bit. Yes, it would have been a tent. It would have been terribly deep. And again, we probably had some sandbags around it. The tent would be probably. Because we have two campers, small, this table, one side here, and then on each side you have the first part, and then the pocket.
Now, what equipment did you have as an officer?
Personal equipment. Well, one had one's main uniforms, the quality uniforms, the quality of this, that, and the other, sand brown, all that sort of thing. Would be in a tin box left at base depot near Cairo. When you knew you were going up front, you would have pack all that stuff away, named stencil on the top of the trunk, and that would be stored until you came back to base depot, if you came back, and then you'd collect it to wherever you were going next. You couldn't take all that up. So really, one's own stuff wasn't in a suitcase, it was in some sort of a rucksack bag, I suppose. But that was dealt with by the batman. We had one batman between the two officers.
I'll come back. But so what exactly uniformed equipment would you have?
I had in battle dress. It could have been in summer or winter. If it was winter, it was normal battle dress.
Summer, I think, during that summer.
You'd have only khaki shorts, quite soft boots. You had a bit of a choice with your boots, and you used to have what's called brothel creepers. You know, they were phrase brothel creepers.
What exactly were they?
They were canvas top and probably some sort of rubber or leather underneath. And very soft.
A bit like plimsolls.
Yes, but very pretty. They were more like trainers. Yes, they were much more like trainers. Very soft and very much more comfortable and good on the sand. But that, you know, was all very soft there. Shorts, if you like, long shorts, shirts, and with a khaki kind of shirts, pockets, and you'd have a forage cap and also a peak cap. We must have had helmets, but I don't remember. So the men on the guns would they have steel helmets?
Would you always wear your shirt? I mean, the men often strip down to shorts, but the officer
generally wore shirts. Yes. You didn't wear ties.
And what about your equipment?
The my equipment in weapons.
Well, your valise or anything like that.
Well, that would be in the tent, and if we were moving off anywhere, it was the batman's job to wrap up everything, your shaving equipment and all that.
So that's what I mean. Yeah. What was it? We'll come to the Batman.
Oh, well, it had obviously shaving equipment. Shaving was very important. And very rare was the time when you didn't shave in the morning. However difficult it was, that was important. You have some kinds of medication. Because I started developing hemorrhoids. Hemorrhoids were a family problem. And
I'll come back to that. Yeah.
And so it had that. It had one's own letters you'd write, pen, handkerchiefs, underwear, change of underwear, pyjamas. Yes, we used to put on pyjamas.
Any more hard, table or not table, oh, but a chair or anything? Any sort of stool?
Chairs, like the sort of chairs you have now on the terrace, the wooden thing you get folded up, the canvas, wooden. Frame the canvas in between, have a couple of them, it's that one each, and there'd be a sort of table. You see, in the officer's tent, there also quite a bit of sort of work, administrative work could be done, dealing with making returns. You had a constant return, or the sergeants often did that, but you had to deal with it as well. On the in the GPO, for the one position itself, it would be mainly items relating to the fighting. We have maps, charts, and telephones, computer telephones, some of which were linked to the public system if you were thought allowed. When it was settled down, it was linked up with the Alexandria public telephone. But you also had a secure phone going to your own headquarters, that type of thing. Didn't have any peripheries, didn't have any pictures, of course. We didn't have any flowers.
Any other equipment in the command post, the gun position command post?
You'd have your mugs, of course, for tea, a very important regular thing. You have the crockery with the tin plates and things. We didn't have much. I was had cigarette lighters, but cigarettes were a thing.
What about more artillery equipment? I mean, the not an artillery ball, because it's a different sort of artillery, but any sort of technical
manuals, did we have? I suppose we had manuals, but don't seem to remember of needing to refer to them. So there must be, we had a book on military law, which was the end of that. I used to look at it maybe for a matter of interest, the law had been my subject, but. No, you don't have much of that. You have your own private books, and you read it. You carry those on the camera, and like your photographs. You may have photographs, staff, or cardigans, and that type of thing, but it was very simple.